You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. For more information about this podcast, please check out nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. My guest for episode 85 is John Etheridge, an amazing guitarist. He started in the British blues boom in the late 60s, played in some bands like the Deep Purple offshoot Warhorse, had its first compositions with curved air violinist Daryl Way's band Wolf, playing on three of his albums in the early 70s. And then he joined the latter lineups of Soft Machine. And you're right now listening to Huffin from their last proper album, Alive and Well, recorded in Paris from 1978. We are today going to be talking about the new lineup of Soft Machine and John's composition, One Glove, from their new album, Hidden Details, 2018. We're then going to look at how he covered in a solo guitar setting a standard My Romance. That's from his album, I Didn't Know, 2004. And then we're going to look back to his first solo album, Ash, from 1994. The song is Venerable Bead. We're going to conclude by listening to a song called Blue Breeze by John and singer Vimala Rao. The album is Out of the Sky from 2015. In addition to his 8 solo albums, his 6 recent albums with the Soft Machine guys, he's also been involved with many collaborations, playing, for instance, in the late 70s with Stefan Grappelli, the violinist most known for his partnership earlier with Django Reinhardt. So if you think of John as the replacement, in a sense, for that legendary jazz guitarist, that tells you something about the skill that John brings to a project. He's also paired up with guitarist John Williams, with Andy Summers from The Police, with Chris Garrick, and others. For more information, look up john-etheridge.com. Hello, John. This is Mark.
Hello, Mark.
So I was very pleased both to have dug around in your catalog myself, trying to figure out what we should talk about, and then hearing your preferences, because I feel like you distributed things across the different styles in much the way that I was aiming to do.
Correct.
Yeah, we've got some kind of prog rock fusion here. We've got a nice solo guitar piece, which is very freeform. And then I was very excited. You know, it seems like a large portion of your work is devoted to combining some sort of traditional styles, in this case, blues, but, blues and old jazz with more adventurous jazz, I guess.
Yes, I think that's fair enough, actually. If there is a thread, hopefully there is, but I'm glad you were going along the same lines as me, because there's a lot to choose from, actually. There should be, as I've been doing it for nearly 50 years.
Well, I've played a little bit of Huffin by your request from the last album from the original Soft Machine run, 1978.
That's right.
Do you want to say a little bit about, before we hear One Glove from the brand new album? There's a lot of transition in there with, you know, iterations of the band in the 80s that you weren't in, and then them getting back together in the early 2000s with 4 of them, which you also weren't in. But then you replaced Alan Holdsworth for the second time.
For the second time.
Yes.
And then we changed the name. Yes, we changed the name to Soft Machine Legacy. And then a couple of years ago, everybody said, in fact, I think quite a lot of the time, promoters were just using the name Soft Machine anyway. So finally, a couple of years ago, we decided to go, well, let's call it Soft Machine. Why not? I mean, when we started in 2004, Elton Dean, Hugh Hopper, myself, and John Marshall were all bona fide members of Soft Machine and had been members for quite a long time. If you take the first arc of the band, which sort of ended, end of the 70s, we'd all been it for quite a long time. And then, of course, I don't really actually know, going back, why we didn't call it Soft Machine straight off. There was a certain kind of diffidence about that. And now we're sort of proudly again Soft Machine, and it's working really well. And yeah, One Glove is a tune of mine off the new album, Hidden Detail. And well, we're very pleased with it. I'm actually pleased with it. I mean, I've liked all the records we've done with Soft Machine Legacy, but this one I particularly like. We did it here at the late John Heisman studio, and he was very much with us at the time. That was a big shock, him going. And it's a tune of mine I sort of put together, and I chose it, I guess, because it's one of my compositions. But there's a lot of variety on the album. And this is more metally, I guess, this tune, One Glove.
In the realm of Led Zeppelin, at least at its starting point.
Ish. Yeah, it's a riffy tune. I've written quite a lot of riffy tunes for the Soft Machine, actually. Great Pound is the tune of mine, actually, that seems to get played the most. And there always seems to be quite a lot of YouTube clips of that. That was on Live Adventures. That's also very riffy. Although there's other compositions of mine on this album that are not riff-based at all, but this is a kind of riff-based tune. So I suppose, you know, the riff started with Charlie Christian. You know that, don't you? With Benny Goodman. That was the first riff-based tunes in the common jazz world were written by Charlie Christian. And so if you want to check those out, like 7 Come 11. In other words, a riff tune is where you've got a riff and then the tune is added on top. and they're kind of separate, you know. So that, I guess, One Glove is a kind of riff tune with some other bits in it. The recording is great, and I'm pleased with the guitar on this album, which is not the main priority. The last album, Burden of Proof, was a good album, but I wasn't that mad about all my guitar playing. But the most important thing is a good overall album, and I think we've made them over the last few years. So there you go, One Glove.
By writing this as a riff, you don't have to actually think in terms of chords exactly, and it invites you to be a little more chromatic, a little more adventurous, than if you just had to say, okay, we're going D to C back to D9th or whatever.
There's another tune of mine on that album, Broken Hill, a ballad with, well, it's not a conventional chord sequence, but it's a ballad with chord sequences. And we do quite a lot of things with the Soft Machine that are modally based, if you like. The solo on One Glove just goes between two chords. I actually like two chords as a basis for a solo rather than one. I think two chords is good. So you have a good long go on one tone center, if you like, and then another go on another tone center. So when you hear this track, you'll hear how the guitar and saxophone solos go between a couple of kind of non-related harmonies. That's what I like too. It's like A, whatever, A, anything, and then C sharp, anything. So it's a shift. It's a proper modulation, if you like.
And it gets a little smoother in that section, in that when you've got this riff and even into the B section, you're still working in, it seems like it's 4.5 measures is a phrase, so that you just add a little extra 2 beats to turn it around.
Yes, you noticed that, did you? Yeah, I just wrote the riff as it was, as I heard it, and it turned out basically it got an extra beat or two. Which is funny because I don't consciously do these things. The same thing happened with Great Pound. The second section of Great Pound has an extra beat added in, and it's like punctuation, and it works well, actually. Those sort of things, you just hear them, and then you work out, oh, that's actually 9 beats or 10 beats or something. But I don't think of them like that. I just do da 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 da, and that works out as, actually, I'd have to count it, but it's not straight 4. But it's not done to deliberately add a beat. It's just how I heard it, how I played it, you know. Then you do tend to bolt on the tune on the top. And the whole thing should work like a clock mechanism, that first bit. So it sort of all fits together like some sort of mechanism. So it's meant to sound quite mechanical, actually, the first part of that tune, deliberately.
But still definitely groove-based. Even back to like take 5, like the kind of odd time signatures that sound natural, it's like everybody could fill up that extra beat or two by yelling, hey, you know, da 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 da, hey, if you're not being subtle about it anyway.
I find writing for whatever group I'm in, I remember they saying this about Duke Ellington. I've never really talked about composing anyway before, because I think of myself as a guitar player who does a bit of composition. But it's always with the band in mind, who's the composition of the band and how it would suit people's playing and the almost the idiom of the group, you know. It's not really trying to compose idiomatically, but it's something about just Soft Machine itself, being in Soft Machine. It's the way, interesting the way the mind works. I immediately start hearing things in a different way than I would, say, composing for some other band. It's not necessarily even being conscious of the past. It's just an atmosphere, Soft Machine atmosphere. And we've certainly got that on this album, I think. It's got a real coherent connection to Soft Machines that have gone before, but at the same time, sounds like us and it's pretty individual.
Yeah, I was noticing that. I had just discovered this morning that, you know, your first live gig with them, apparently, as Soft Machine Legacy, had done a version of Ash off of your solo album. And just listening to the contrast between those, you know, it's much more acid jazz or something, as opposed to traditional jazz. I don't know exactly how to put it, but it gets amped up.
Yeah, Ash, I pinched off my first solo album and presented it when we were looking for stuff to play with the reformed Soft Machine Legacy. And Ash is just about my favorite tune of mine, actually, because it's got a real atmosphere. If you play it right, it's got a real melancholic, then aggressive, then melancholic, then mysterious, then whimsical. So it's got a lot of things in it. I'm not sure it's ever actually been played right. I'm not sure it's ever been recorded right. I mean, the recording on Ash was about the first time the chaps had heard it. So it's quite good, but it's, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, it sounds like I'm being conceited, but I really like that tune. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I've written that I'm not particularly attached to, but that tune I particularly think is good. I like things that are downbeat, really. I'm probably at heart. If left to my own devices, I play practically everything in C minor. You know, I'm a minor key guy, really. You know, grief-stricken.
In addition to the atmosphere on that, it's got a pretty memorable Pat Metheny-like head.
What, you're talking about Ash?
And I'm using that to transition, actually, back to One Glove. So you're starting with the riff, but then you have to write the melody over it. In fact, let me just play one particular turnaround. It's about 19 seconds in on the sax here.
So just that little, you've created a little puzzle for yourself in what's going on in the guitar and bass, like what's going to go over that and actually sound melodic. And that actually really works. That really jumps out right there.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because that was going to come every time. And I think I pulled it out. It only comes every second time. I mean, you see, that's what I quite like about composing as opposed to improvising. When you improvise, there you go. That's it. But with Verzi, you can go, okay, and then why don't I just tweak that tiny little phrase there? And it's quite minute, you know. You start with a broad picture, and then I start filling in the details and pulling out certain details and putting them back. And there again, One Glove is one of these tunes that will develop, I hope, when we play live, because it was rehearsed and recorded and has never been played live yet. And when we play it live, I'm hoping it will really open up and get really settled. You know, this is so often the common thing with particularly jazz recordings, which are done normally pretty quickly, like this album was done. You know, it's live in the studio, basically. You're often playing material that you haven't played live. And what often happens is you play it for 6 months and you go, God, I wish we could re-record it, you know, because we've really nailed it now, you know. So that may happen with One Glove.
Did you have a fifth player in there playing keys? Because otherwise you had at least a little bit of overdubbing here, right? You had organ or something.
That's not keys. That's me underdubbing chords. I think in the middle section, I used an organ simulating pedal quite a lot on this album.
Gotcha.
But Theo Travis also plays keys, but I'm pretty damn sure he doesn't play keys on that track. No, that's me underdubbing after we played it. Yes, of course, of course. But the actual performances are kind of live in the studio. That's how we tend to do things with Soft Machine, because nobody seems to like playing with a click. So we get the basic stuff down live. And there's always places for a bit of overdubbing. I think some of the solos, a few bits of that might have been redone. I know the Hidden Details track, that's completely live. I mean, I think actually overall, so I'm glad we put that first, because that's a track that really kind of sums up the whole thing, really. I mean, it's quite raw. In a way, it sounds 70s in a good way. And it's got this kind of feeling that musicians of my generation sort of have and other generations don't. I mean, it's nothing about being good or bad. It just kind of has it. It's kind of aggressive and it's like grungy jazz, that first track. And One Glove is a little bit grungy jazz.
King Crimson-esque, if people want to weigh in, if they're not familiar with Soft Machine.
King Crimson would be cleaner and more organized.
Mm.
You've got to remember, it's an improvising group, really. I mean, Marshall Babington and me, and certainly Theo Travis, are much more improvising musicians, I'd say, than a lot of what you'd call progressive rock stuff, which is not knocking it, although I love that stuff. Soft Machine has always been more of an improvisational setup.
It's the legacy of the group. Well, what does that mean? For most groups, if you're a 70s group that's still playing now, you know, if King Crimson is going to go out, they have to pull out 21st Century Schizoid Man or something. But it's not like you guys are going to play Hope for Happiness or something from the first album. Like, that was, the lineup had completely turned over by the time any of you were involved. So that sort of classic first couple albums doesn't have to be represented.
We were talking about doing Joy of a Toy. We usually put some of the tunes, say, like on this album, The Man Who Waved at Trains, which I played with Ratledge in the band I was in, but Theo never did. Obviously, well, Theo wasn't in Soft Machine. But the Hugh Hopper album tunes we play, Kings and Queens, Chloe and the Pirates, another Ratledge tune I never played when I was in the band, and Gazulriot we never played. So we do them actually completely in our own way. In fact, so much so that I don't actually listen to the originals. I remember, for instance, with Gazulriot, Hugh Hopper brought it in, just the top line, and we played it, sax and guitar, unison. I have seen a YouTube clip of that, but Chloe and the Pirates, I don't think I've ever heard the original. And that's actually how I like to work, because it sounds disrespectful, but it isn't, actually, because you're playing the composition that the composer played and you're playing it in your own way with integrity. So it's not disrespectful, but it means that you're kind of free, where some people, and I know what you're saying about reconstruction. I mean, I just did a few gigs as a guest of Caravan. You know Caravan, don't you? Pye Hastings, all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I was very happy to do that. The gig we were on, the prog rock gig, and Martin Turner did the whole of Argus, I think. Kind of pretty well note for note. Wishbone Ash, like complete recreation. Very good. Two great guitarists. Sounded great. And of course, the audience love it because they've come for that. They've been told this will be a recreation of Argus. And there you go. That's great as well, but that's not what we do. And probably You couldn't do that with Soft Machine. It wouldn't work, like Kings and Queens, for instance. There's no way you could sort of recreate them note for note. It kind of wouldn't work. I'm not against that. I'm not against anything. I'm actually for everything. So, I mean, if a prog rock back wants to put together as close as possible a version of one of its famous albums, I think that's fine. And in fact, Martin Turner's Argus Wishbone Ash thing was brilliant. With Soft Machine, it just wouldn't happen. So I think our balance is really good. We got, I should say, 60-40 new material, old material. And the old material is done in a completely fresh way because we've got no keyboards. Well, we have got a bit of keyboards, but basically it's guitar, bass, drums and saxophone. And there was no Soft Machine lineup that was of that nature. So it's not going to sound like Soft Machine anyway. See what I mean? It's not going to sound like old Soft.
Before we leave One Glove and the current Soft Machine album, so we talked about the intro riff, we've talked about the solos. Let's play a little of the B section here, which is kind of I wrote spy music. So kind of related to the intro in the rhythm, it still has the same 4.5 measure thing.
It's actually a diminished scale.
Okay.
The melody made out of diminished scale. So yeah, spy music, possibly. Yeah, possibly.
Someone creeping and looking in files. Anyways, folks like me who are used to just writing songs, right? That sections get determined more or less by what you want to do vocally, you know, that we've got our verse, then maybe we'll have a pre-chorus that'll kind of go to in a slightly different direction, and then we'll pound the chorus here. This song is just as structured as a pop song like that. Of course, some of the sections are a little stretched out, but it's overall a pretty compact compared to a lot of Soft Machine material. It's a very structured and compact thing.
This is the album overall. That's why I think it works, because I thought, well, there'll be one or two tunes that are compact. And there'll be lots of tunes that are very, very rambling and blowing and improvisational. So I kind of deliberately made this compact. Even the solo sections are quite short, you know, and it's all quite, I don't know how much it comes in at 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes maybe. But it's quite abbreviated and quite compact. The thing is about the modern world, I still think of albums in terms of an overall architecture. But of course, nobody listens to an album. Sits down and listens to it now. They just pick out the odd track. So you can have a very successful album with practically every track sounding the same. I mean, I'm not going to mention some famous albums I've got here where practically every track sounds the same. And people don't seem to mind that because they'll pick out a couple of tracks and they'll just play them. But I still have this idea of an album being a kind of coherent unit. So an album like this, you can think of it as, say, Jackson Pollock's Blue Poles. You've got 4 or 5 poles, one of which is One Glove. And then you've got lots of stuff in between, which is all miasmic and, you know, Hidden Deep, Each Other's Tracks is one, and Theo's 14 Hour Dream is another one, which are kind of fixed compositions. And then you've got lots of stuff, which is basically improvisations, or improvisations where there's perhaps a little bit of written riff to join it up.
Yeah, well, let's transition and keep this idea of structure in mind as we're going into My Romance from the album I Didn't Know, 2004. So this is a mostly guitar solos album, correct?
I wasn't quite sure whether to choose stuff that was all written by me or not, because there is a kind of blues tune called With the Wind on that album. But My Romance, I remember it being a pretty nice performance that I was quite pleased with.
Thank you. So there's definite melodies that jump out in here. It's obviously composed, but how different would this be from performance to performance?
That's a very good question, because this is a tune by, is it Rodgers, My Romance? I mean, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, it's a standard tune.
Yep.
Right? So this isn't my tune. So what I do with something like this, if I like a tune like that, which I do, I'll probably know or listen to, or I might even look it up, the basic chord structure, right? Okay. Then given the basic chord structure and the melody, I will then add chord substitutions and things, moving bass lines, moving harmonies. So we then end up with something that is, if one's honest, there's quite a bit of that would be the same between performances. Not identical, not like a classical guitar piece, but quite the same, because I'm using my fingers, I'm playing the melody and the bass and the chords running together. I kind of know where I'm going. But what would be different would be the middle section where I do a bit of improvising. But frankly, with solo guitar pieces like that, you'll find that they are fairly similar each time you play it. Not completely similar. I mean, I do a duo with John Williams. You know, I've done that for years. And of course, John absolutely plays a piece and he knows exactly, and he's worked to get it to a pitch where he knows exactly what's going to happen all the time. Now, I never get that far, but the basic way of playing that tune, I can more or less see, visualize here how I play it. And because the chords are moving pretty fast and you've got to play the melody on top, that's fairly worked out. It's like you're 50% of the composition. You can't claim the money, but you are 50% of the composition, you know, because the basic tune has any manner of possibilities, rhythmic and harmonic in it. And then I think I do a little bit of actual soloing. So in a way, it's a bit like any band. Imagine if My Romance was being played by a group, you'd have a sort of arrangement for the top, then you play solos, and then you have an arrangement for the end. And so it's similar. And I do a sort of improvised introduction, but I chose that quite quickly. But I remember it being when I released that album, radio stations kind of picked out that track to play. So I thought that's probably a good one to play, because most of that album is either traditional songs that I've rearranged, like Motherless Child, or kind of jazz standards. Or there was one blues thing that I play, which is basically an improvisation called With the Wind, which is a blues improvisation. And that would be a completely off the wall thing, unarranged, and would be different every time, completely different. But, you know, I could play My Romance in various different ways, but, you know, that way I play it is quite ingrained in my mind. So it would almost be a piece, I'd say.
Yeah, that intro, very pretty, totally unconnected to the rest of the song in terms of those don't come back.
That's fair comment. That's fair comment. In fact, I remember when I played that intro and played the first line of the melody, I thought this is really good. And the engineer said, oh, that's really nice. So I think the intro has a good feeling to it.
The use of rubato here, this we're going fast and then we're slowing down and we're going fast and then we're slowing. That seems like ideally set up for the kind of semi-improvisation that you're talking about, that you can kind of stop, decide what you're going to do next. And
oh, exactly. Well, you're on your own. The thing about playing on your own, it always impressed me with people like Joe Pass, that I suppose they'd spent so long, like I have actually, so long playing with bands and groups, that when they played that on their own, they sort of almost like imagined a drummer and a bass player behind them. But actually, when you're on your own, you can move the tempo around, go forward, go back, stop for a bit, fiddle around for a bit. Provided you keep a coherence in your performance, there's nothing to stop you doing that because there's no drummer or bass player to go, oi, what are you doing? You can just do what you want. And I find a lot of solo guitarists, particularly in the jazz-ish area, play quite straight. So when I do, I've done two solo albums, and the second one, the live one, there's some quite far out stuff on it where I'm just going for it, particularly use of pedals, which I find a great boon for playing solo. Because I had a period where I played loads of solo gigs, and I find pedals, looping pedals and things, a real boon because you can lay down some loops spontaneously and then you can go for it over the top and really, it's like you've got your own little backing and you can really improvise. I mean, I'm always aiming to improvise as much as possible. The reason is I find it more relaxing. Some people find it relaxing to know exactly what they're going to do and have it all worked out. I find that very stressful. I find it much more relaxing if it's just like, okay, just, play what you want, improvise. And funnily enough, there's two kinds of people in the world, people who find that difficult to cope with and people who find that much easier to cope with than playing written parts. I find playing written parts and fixed pieces much more stressful. So I tend to look for every improvisational possibility. It's just my temperament. I don't no longer have a feeling that certain people are better than other people because they improvise or don't improvise. It's just how you are.
Was your looping setup fancy enough so that you could do your preferred, not just jamming over one chord for a long time, but I have my one chord loops and then I hit a pedal and now it's recording. I'm going to play a second chord and then I capture that as a separate loop. And then you have those so you can go back and forth between them.
Of course. I've used over the years kind of two kind of loops. There's the short loop, which you can add to and subtract from, et cetera, et cetera. And then occasionally, and I've tried to back off on this because it gets to sound a bit karaoke, is the long loop where you've got the whole chord sequence and then play over the top. But for some reason, I find that getting a bit karaoke. So I prefer the short loops with plenty of adding stuff. And also I like loops with noises. When I play solo, I always do a version of kind of Little Wing that starts off for about 20 minutes of noises with looping noises and backwards noises. And the other thing I like about pedals is the improvisational aspect of pedals is you kind of let the pedals take over. So you let the pedals take you where they want you to go. You stop dictating the course so much. So you sort of try one sound and go, whoa, and what happens if I add that to, ooh, and what happens if I add that? Ooh, that's good. Oh, that's taking me over there. And I like that aspect of it. It's like relinquishing control a bit, which of course you do when you're playing in a band. But when you're playing solo, relinquishing control is not quite so easy. And of course, if playing solo, you never get that feeling that you get when you're playing with a band of like taking off together and going somewhere. I mean, that's when I really appreciate the idea of proper improvisation is when a band goes somewhere together. You're all together and you kind of know where you're going, or some of the time you don't, but you're all together. I don't know if people in other genres get that feeling, really. I don't know. You're there in the moment and it's all happening. And the other thing I found about playing solo was every single possible thing that could go wrong has gone wrong on one of my solo gigs. And the only time I couldn't really get through it was when I leant over and my main guitar fell on the stage and smashed in front of the audience. That was about the only time when I looked at the audience, I said, oh, I can't even think of something amusing to say about this. That was pretty desperate. But every other time, pedals have broken down. They haven't worked. They don't go up. You press your octave pedal, it goes up a major seventh, you know. And you just deal with this stuff in the moment. And it's good fun. And it's quite good fun to deal with it. And the audience like to see you dealing with it. And they think it's a laugh as well. So it's great. Everything can go wrong. You can play bad. And I just stop and go, oh, God, I played that awfully. I'll try again. And that's one of the liberating things about playing solo. You know, you start playing a tune and it goes wrong. You just stop and go, oh, I'm really sorry. oh, God, I don't know what's got into me today. Got to stop smoking that stuff or something like that. You make a joke of it and start again. And you get the audience on your side and everything's fine. So that's hard to do with a band because they look at you and go, oi, you start with a group and then stop after eight bars. Go, hang on, boys. You can't really do that. So I really enjoy playing solo in a lot of ways. In other ways, I don't, but in many ways, I do. So there you go.
Let me play a little bit from near the end, about 2.5 minutes in. You reached an interesting kind of little climax here.
Most of it is not repeatable. It just sort of happens, as I say. But certainly the first part, not the intro, but the first part of the tune, mm-hmm. The first part of the melody is an arrangement. The rest, probably, there are things happening that are just happening in the moment and wouldn't happen again.
It's a very full arrangement in that tonally, you're picking out a couple melody notes with your fingers, you know, really loud, and then immediately following up, I guess, with your thumb, with the accompanying that's supposed to answer. And it really is kind of designed to sound like a different instrument. It's not just on different strings, but it's a totally different dynamic and tone.
I do aim for that. I mean, I remember when I heard Lenny Bro, I was really knocked out with the way he got a separation between his melody notes and his chordal accompaniment, which, of course, is something classical guitarists do. I try and play the melody a bit stronger and the accompaniment a bit softer. You are aiming to give the impression of perhaps two or three instruments, you know, but it's only an impression because, of course, you can't do real counterpoint on the guitar. You get the illusion of counterpoint. So I can play stuff on the guitar that sounds like there are two separate things going on, but they're not actually. You know, if I play, can you hear? Okay, so if I play I Got Rhythm like that with a walking bass line, it sounds like there's two things, at least two things, perhaps three things going on. But of course, the way I've worked it out, when you're at a piano, really your left hand is doing something on your right hand is doing something.
Sure.
But on guitar, it's not like that. You give the illusion that you've got a bass line and a top line going, but they're not really independent. They just sound independent when you hear them. In fact, I've got a few tracks on that album where I use a guitar with two bass strings on.
The title track that I didn't know, I was listening closely through that and...
That's overdub.
Okay. It's either bass strings or an actual bass in the intro. Like you're mixing this up a little bit.
Yes. I'm not sure about that track, but they're certainly on Mercy, 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 I think. And Lullaby of Birdlands on that. That's with a walking bass line. In other words, it's got a walking bass line that's an octave down. So it really sounds like you're playing with a bass guitarist, but it's just me. And of course, that does take a bit of working out. But that's all there on that album and on the follow-up album, Alone Live. I'm quite pleased with that. I mean, I can't claim it as an original idea. A friend of mine said he'd seen a guitarist in Oklahoma City. He was playing a standard guitar with two bass guitar strings on the bottom. So I tried it and it works a treat because all your fingering is exactly the same and it works a treat. So if anybody wants to go and look up the rest of this album, they'll find a couple of tracks where there's actual bass strings. I think it's Lullaby of Birdland and Mercy, Mercy.
Well, let's transition to our third song, Venerable Bede.
Yeah, I chose that from Ash because you suggested something from my first ever solo album. The title track, Ash, I was going to play, but it's very long and it takes ages to get going, which I now look back on as a mistake. But at the time, I was still in the idea that people would sit down quietly and put on the album and chill out. But of course, all that finished in the 70s. But Ash is a lovely track. But Venerable Bede is a little bluesy composition of mine. You know, I like to write. I don't think it's particularly amazing tune or anything, but it's a sort of blues thing with some quirky chords. And I just like that. It just interests me. And it means you can get a blues feeling and yet some sort of harmonic interest, which kind of tickles the ear somewhat. I'm pleased with that tune. The only thing when I listen to that track is I only do one chorus. It's very short. It's one chorus of guitar, one chorus of organ, and the solo is going quite well. And I keep thinking, oh, I could have done another chorus. But I was quite fairly influenced by John Scofield at this time of my life, and it's a bit Scofieldy. But I do like it, and I still play this tune. And I suppose, you know, without... being too self-conscious. I think why I'd write something like that is because it's got elements that I like. It's got a bluesy feeling. It's got kind of humour, which is very important to me, and people often don't pick up on. ¶¶ it's got sort of harmonic interest, as well as hopefully having a good kind of 12-8 group. The idea is you've got so question and answer, phrases answering each other with little stops and things, and it should have dynamics as well. That's often quite difficult to get with jazz musicians, to get them to play loud and soft, because the last phrase, da 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 da, that should be kind of so triumphant, almost like tongue-in-cheek triumphant, and then ba do do da 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 da, kind of sneaky, da 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 da. So there should be like proper dynamics in it. Whether it's on the record, I'm not sure if it came off like that, but that's how it should be. But it's often quite difficult to get the idea of volume dynamics with jazz and rock musicians. They don't tend to think like that. That's what how I'd like that to be played, ideally. We're all talking ideally about these things, not necessarily how they were actually played on the record, but ideally. And calling it the Venerable Bede is a semi-humorous thing. He was the first historian in the English language, the Venerable Bede. He was a monk who lived in the 6th century AD, lived in Jarrow in northern England. When you guys weren't even, your ancestors were wherever they were in Central Europe. But Venerable Bede was writing his histories, and he wrote the first history of the English-speaking peoples in 6th century AD. What about that? I don't know why I chose his name for the title of that tune. I think I was just being pretentious. But anyway, but it's part of the humour. So the humour is an important part of a tune like that. In fact, I think humour is a very important part. In fact, if you talk about John Scofield, I remember when he was kind of a big deal in the 80s, and I was saying to a guy who was into him, I said, you know, remember, this is kind of humorous thing. This playing outside is kind of humorous. It's ironic. He went, You see, a lot of, particularly jazz people, they don't talk about the kind of psychological or emotional content of the music. They don't think about it. And of course, it's incredibly important. And Scofield is quite humorous. I hear a lot of humor or irony, as opposed to, say, Massini. Well, I don't hear much, or Mike Stern. But Scofield, definitely humorous. I was quite under his influence at this time.
I was noticing in particular the big riff. Which is the only place where it sounds a little dated, just in that the synth sound, you know, we have a flash of 80s jazz rock, you know, coming in here, whereas the rest is, you know, it could be John Lee Hooker.
That's good, and that's good observation. I mean, I know Steve Franklin, who, I love that guy on keyboards. He was very keen on those analog sounds, on those pre-digital sounds. And is it a Prophet or something he's playing there? But he was very specific about the kind of sounds he wanted to use. And I leave it to him. I mean, I'm not dictatorial in my group. That's another thing. I'm not interested in laying down the law about what people play. I say, right, here's my tune. Let's see where we can go with this. And you bring what you can. And very occasionally I might say, well, I don't really like that sound, or can you not play there or something? But I mean, this is the essence of it. I mean, you choose your players and they play. That's a very important part of this whole business as well. So he kind of chose those sounds. And even at the time, I remember when the album came out, they were going on about the synth sound being dated and all that. But I'm happy with this. And his synth playing, actually, I love him. We do a version of Ron Carter's 81. And I do a solo and he takes the baton off me. And I love his solo. It's not really 80s. It's like late 70s, early 80s, you know, monophonic synth sounds, analog, very powerful, oscillators or whatever it is. I don't know, but I know what you mean. It does sound kind of dated. And then, but that's good. I don't take that as any kind of criticism. I accept that, where he plays the chords really heavy.
Contributes to the strange blend that this is, that, you know, a lot of people who play this kind of music are very traditionalists. And so if I can play your guitar solo from here, comment on, so it starts about 2 minutes, 18 seconds in.
Thank you.
Yeah, so starts very kind of traditionally bluesy and quickly gets more long-winded, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's me. You know, most of these things like that, that's how I feel about things. I mean, really, I like that dialogue between the traditional and the outside, if you like. That's why I'm not that totally attracted to players who play with nothing in the common denominator, right? I admire them, of course, but I don't. They don't actually appeal to me. And then I'm not that interested in players who are totally in the common denominator, as it were, however skillful they are. You know, so, I mean, there's some great players. I'm not going to name any names, but there's some great players, particularly on the sort of, you know, blues rock scene, who have magnificent sound and everything. But you know what's going to happen. It's all in the common denominator. This is why I like Jeff Beck. Of all the rock guitarists I'd like to listen to now, Jeff Beck has got to be the man, because, you know, there's a lot of what you might call my common ground there, where you go, oh, yeah. And then it sort of does something slightly quirky and you go, wow, you know, I don't hear that from most people in rock now. I don't hear anything quirky. But with Beck, you hear something where you go, oh, wow, oh, really? And that's what I like to do. And I quite like that solo on Venerable Bee, because it does that. It's sort of in the blues tradition, then it's not, then it is, then it isn't, and it is. And the whole point is to take somebody on a journey. So if you start in the common arena, that gives the listener a feeling of, I know where I am now, I'm comfortable. And then you go, oh, where's he taking me now? Oh, he's taking me down a funny passage. Oh, right. Oh, now we're okay. We're back in there. Okay. That's what I feel you should be doing as a soloist, you know, taking people on a little journey. You don't have to stay in the clearing, in the bright sunshine all the time. You want to go through a little, you know, down a little few funny little paths. And then, but we'll probably bring you back. Okay, you know, and you've had a little adventure in sound. So that's what it's about, and that's certainly what Jeff Beck does to me. And it's what, as I said before, Schofield in his heyday was, well, even now, of course, he's still in his heyday, but, you know, back then he was sort of doing, it's like, oh, yeah, there's some common denominator, there's some common stuff, which is agreed, you know, pentatonic scale or something, and then, I say. It doesn't have to be going on at a conscious level with the listener. Because the two things you've got to do if you're soloing, first of all, you've got to draw the listener in. So you've got to do something. I mean, when I saw Eric Clapton in 1965, what he was doing was well enough to completely draw me in. But within 2 years, everybody had copied him to death. So that style in itself wouldn't necessarily draw you in. If you went into a club and heard somebody going, in 1965, he was the only person doing it, you went, blimey, I've never heard anything like that. But within 3 years, you just go, oh, guitar solo. Yeah, yeah, okay, right, okay. There's always got to be, as well as the sensitivity in it and the musicality and the feeling, there's got to be something that causes the listener to prick up their ears.
So I think there are two ways, though, to do that. I mean, when I was just talking to Phil Manzanera, like, he'll even use an effects pedal or post-processing to add an extra layer of acid trip, impossible spinning notes out of control. But that's very different to me than somebody who has really listened and internalized jazz and the longer phrases that sort of become more naturally, that just saying the melody is not enough, that you got to just keep plowing through for another three measures before you get to the end of the phrase. Like, that's a whole different vocabulary.
Well, yes. I mean, you don't want to plow on through. I've noticed from bank balance point of view that the richest guitarists seem to be the ones who play the less notes. In the history of music, the most well-paid recorded guitarist in the history of music per note must be Dave Gilmour, I think, of Pink Floyd. And the least well-paid will be all these kind of incredibly fast jazz guys.
I'm more thinking the spirit of John Coltrane is that it's very soulful and it's still coming from a traditionalist place, but has, that's just the way he would think, is in long sentences. Like,
yeah, I think the problem with John Coltrane is there's not a problem with John Coltrane himself. There's a problem with John Coltrane's imitators. Now, some people's imitators can do well. Like Eric Clapton's imitators, say Joe Bonamassa or something, you can go around, and that is a style that everybody loves. Everybody loves that style. And Eric stopped playing like that in 1969. But people have made money and got popularity out of playing that way ever since. I mean, in the 90s, it was Gary Moore. Now it's Joe Bonamassa. That is a very popular style. But Coltrane, if you take away his spiritual intensity and just play the fast notes, I'm sorry, you know, audiences, people listening, don't really like it.
Sure, sure.
And this is one of the great drawbacks of jazz, is people playing post Coltrane without the integrity and intensity of his spirit. It doesn't really happen. You see, you can take the Clapton style. I mean, obviously, you've got to play it with skill and the right sound, but it's such a beautiful style on its own that it can be imitated really easily. It's like Stan Getz. You can play like Stan Getz, and people will love that till the cows come home.
Not so much Eric Dolphy.
No, exactly. Not so much Eric Dolphy. Exactly. Or Coltrane, because you get Coltrane's spiritual intensity, which you feel through the notes. If you haven't got that, if you're just going, oh, Coltrane, yeah, great scales, mate. Yeah, I'll play all these scales like Coltrane. Well, I'm sorry, you know. You don't blame me if nobody wants to hear you. And that's a bit the same on guitar. I mean, you know, I'm not exempting myself from this, but because we all tend to do it. But I do understand that playing a lot of really long lines, because as you pointed out, like a conversation, I think in essence, and I'm not saying I'm not, I don't follow this myself all the time, but in essence, playing a coherent solo let's talk about soloing, is like having a conversation with the audience. You're telling them things. If you switched on your tape recorder and I just didn't stop talking for an hour and a half, you'd probably go, wow, God, that was amazing. He didn't stop talking for an hour and a half. But you wouldn't have listened and you wouldn't want to hear it again. You'd just be impressed. And the trouble is, after Coltrane, everybody got in this idea of you've got to play a solo that lasts for an hour to show you've got stamina, to show you're a man. You know, oh, God. And I've been involved in all that. I'm not a critic of anything, but I do understand why that doesn't appeal to large amounts of people.
Well, I think this will transition us well to introducing the last song, Blue Breeze, by you and Vimala Rao.
Will transition, because I've got a lot to say about this, because when I met Vimala Rao and I started working with her, I hadn't really had an intense kind of musical relationship with a singer really before. And I thought, like, musicians think of singers in a certain way and singers think of musicians in a certain way. It's not always that positive. You know, you immediately realize so many things, that the human voice is what you should be aiming to imitate, not the other way around, not the vocalist trying to imitate an instrument. So get back to the Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix thing. What appealed about those people? Because they made the guitar sound like a human voice, like it was singing. And immediately you make your instrument sing. So you work with a great vocalist like her, and you realize, and then this ties in with Jeff Beck and how I want to approach my playing now, that every note is treated with a quality. In the case of a singer, it usually involves a word. So they're thinking about the word. And that helps them to give every note a distinctive shape, often based on the word. It's the opposite of, say, George Benson. I mean, I love George Benson, but it's the opposite of that. You know, with standard jazz guitar, one note quickly follows another because the note itself is so short and so dry that you've got to play millions of them. You know, if you just go ping, there's nothing there. But a singer doesn't go ping, 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 ping. A singer goes, and then a note might be longer. And that's another thing guitarists don't think enough about, is the end of the note. They think about the beginning of the note, but the end of the note. Now, when you've got a bit of sustain on your amp, or you're using some sort of overdrive pedal or something, and you've got a cranked up sound, you've got quite a lot of control about how that note ends. Now, a lot of people just automatically use a kind of heavy vibrato without thinking about it. I mean, there are a lot of technically great guitarists who just do this heavy vibrato without thinking about it. And it happens to me sometimes when I'm nervous or not thinking, you know, I find, oh, God, I'm tripping this vibrato and everything. Because you can shape the end of the note. Now, a singer not only shapes the attack at the front, also shapes the decay, and a saxophone can obviously do that, but an overdrive guitar, you know, a guitar with a sort of what you call a rocky overdrive sound, can do that as well. Now, somebody like Jeff Beck is doing that, and of course a singer like Vimala is doing that all the time. I mean, all the time, the end of the note is as important as the beginning of the note, and these things are lessons you learn from working with a great singer. You know, this is just part of what I'm talking about. I mean, obviously, I'm very pleased with this album. And I met her and she wasn't doing much. I instigated this album and it was really kind of, I wanted to do an album with her to sort of showcase her and the things she can do. She's also an amazingly good swing, Billie Holiday-esque jazz singer. I mean, fantastic. She's got most remarkably good time in a completely unselfconscious way. Because when I first met her, we did a gig with a friend of mine on bass, and the bass player at the end of the gig said, "Wow, Tim, you've got great time." And she looked at me all paranoid. "Is that good? Is that good?" And I said, "Yes." Yeah. So she instinctively swings. On this album, I said, "Look, you'll probably make a jazz album, and this is just the two of us. So let's do some songs that aren't, you know, in the normal thing." And Blue Breeze was something we put together. She had a gig with Paco Peña, the flamenco guitarist, out of the blue. There again, sort of came from me. He asked me for a recommendation for a blues singer, and I said, "I know exactly the right person." So Vimala did this season with him, with the flamenco act, doing a kind of slightly bluesy song with the flamenco people. In fact, she did it a cappella, just on her own, and it's amazing. And so I put a bit of guitar to it. So we came up with this Blue Breeze. She wrote the lyrics and pretty well the melody. And I just added my chords and the harmony and put it together and arranged it. Just like, you know, there again, it's fairly spontaneous. And the other thing, of course, as soon as you work with a singer, and this is, of course, what musicians don't like, the whole room is looking at the singer. People respond to the human voice. It doesn't matter what you're like on your instrument. I don't in any way take this personally. They do listen to you. And she, you know, I do a lot of soloing when we play live. Usually I loop a bit and solo a bit and blah, blah, blah. But everybody in the room focuses on a great singer. And that's why singers make millions and instrumentalists don't. Because people relate to a singer and a song. That is really, in essence, what they actually deep down want to hear. So that's also a kind of eye-opener to me, because if you think about instrumental-only bands, probably the most popular instrumental-only person is Jeff Beck, or perhaps Pat Metheny. But Jeff Beck, probably. Can you think of anybody else who, as an instrumentalist, can...
Kenny G.
Kenny G. Yes, he can fill a decent size hall. Kenny G. Okay, no, I'm not going to knock him. Don't get that out of me. Yes, Kenny G, Dave Sanborn in his heyday. Yes. But of course, it's all like filling a decent-sized hall. It's not mega stadiums. It's that songs. People going around with their headphones on, singing songs. The only reason why I say this is because if you're in the jazz world, there's so much snobbery about how stupid people are and they don't appreciate how brilliant we are because we're playing over these complicated changes. And you go, well, why the hell should they? These people go to work for 10 hours. They're worried about their rent. They're worried about their relationship. They want to hear a song that says something to them. And if I can get that spirit into my instrumental playing and I can get people to kind of go, oh, I don't play the guitar. I'm not interested in jazz, but I really got it when you played. That's the victory for me. And of course, playing with Vimala, I mean, she starts singing and everybody absolutely entranced. I mean, they're mesmerized. You know, she's had a sort of up and down sort of life. She's having up and down. So she's the sort of person who in another era would have been picked up and become a kind of big name act, which we're hoping she will be, because she's great. This album, you know, hopefully showcases her well. And it hasn't got, as I say, it hasn't got the swing kind of stuff that she does so well, because it's just me and her, and she does that with other groups, and she's a really charismatic and amazing performer, amazing singer. So I was very happy to do this album, and I think this track, unless they say it's representative of the album, but I put it first on the album because it's the most extreme, if you like. It's the most unexpected. I've got a theory that the first track of an album defines the album. In other words, if I put, say, on this album with her, there's a couple of jazz ballads played as a duo. So I'd put on that first. It would have been, here's an album of jazz ballads, and yet there's some other stuff on it. If I put Blue Breeze on first, it's like, this album, wow, it's got some quite way out stuff on it, and it's got some jazz. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So your opening track absolutely says this is where I were at with this album. The same thing with the Soft Machine. I said, there's only one possible track we can start this with, Hidden Details, because it's got everybody full on. It's got all sorts of things going on. And even though it wasn't my track, I mean, it's not my decision, it's a cooperative, but I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's not my track, it's written by Theo. And it's like says, this album will have a lot of variations, but kind of this is the essence of it. And the thing with Blue Breeze on Out of the Sky, I thought, this is a hardcore tune. It's a cry from the heart. It's quite demanding to listen to, but I'm going to put it first on the album.
All right, and that album was Out of the Sky, recorded in 2015. Just one of the many, many collaborations we could have chosen from. You just got such a varied catalog of stuff. Thanks so much for the opportunity to dive into it and to talk to you about this.
Yeah, we should mention all those other people we could have played, like Stefan Grappelli, and I was with for years. I mean, that's a whole story as well. And John Williams, who I've been playing duos with, and now trio. We've got a great album out. I'm just saying that there's people who might want to check it out. You know, and Andy Summers, that our album, nice album we made, acoustic, kind of strummy kind of album. So there's loads of stuff, you know, but we've touched on some of it. That's great.
Well, thanks so much. Have a great rest of your day.
No, thank you, Mark. Thanks for doing that, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Blue breeze, my soul's entangled, how the wicked weave. They won't let me feeding on the make. False remedies they eat, coming while knowing they're sowing the seeds. Where are roots away? Where are roots away? Where are roots away? Will change, let the wicked leave.
Thanks so much to John, a fountain of wisdom there. Again, look him up at john-etheridge.com. You can find the new Soft Machine album on Bandcamp. It is great. My next interview will be with Bruce Sword, the frontman and guitarist for The Pineapple Thief, a British prog band for the modern day. You can get that and my other interviews at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you enjoy what we're doing, please kick in a few nickels. You can sign up to become a recurring supporter at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So be creative, be inspired, keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.